The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
The story of the UK is an economy that has got real momentum.
What is broken can be repaired. What is ruined can be rebuilt.
UK inflation is becoming much more homegrown.
We have huge potential as an economy in the UK.
This is a time to tell Israel there is a path to peace.
Our plan for the British economy is working, but the work is not done.
You're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm James Woolcock. Now, the Prime Minister has called it an epoch-defining challenge, and he's referring to China. China's policies have implications for almost every government policy and the everyday lives of British people. Those were Sunak's words, and now the UK, the US and New Zealand are all accusing Beijing of a string of attacks on institutions and politicians, including ones in Britain. Here's Deputy Prime Minister Oliver Dowden formally accusing the country of accessing the data of 40 million British voters held by the Electoral Commission.
That is why the United Kingdom has sanctioned two individuals and one entity associated with the Chinese state-affiliated APT 31 group for involvement in malicious cyber activity targeting officials, government entities and parliamentarians.
Now, Dowden there issuing sanctions when speaking to Parliament. But this morning, Education Secretary Gillian Keegan told broadcasters that the government is still trying to avoid what she called trade issues, despite the action. Well, joining us now with more on this unfolding story is Bloomberg anchor and former Beijing correspondent Tom McKenzie. Tom, you've been covering China's relationship with the world and with the UK for a long period of time. Are these kind of big bombshell accusations from yesterday just another ordinary step in a long trend, or do they represent something else?
I certainly wouldn't describe it as an ordinary step in a long trend. I would say it's not unsurprising. For those of us who have followed this story, frankly, it would be unsurprising if China wasn't launching and wasn't involved in these kind of hacking campaigns. Nonetheless, the allegations that have come through from New Zealand, the UK and the US are very serious indeed. And it sounds like a very concerted effort on the behalf of this particular unit that is based, at least part of it, in the city of Wuhan in central China to target the democratic institutions of these nations, specifically here in the UK, where we know that a number of voter data was allegedly taken or at least accessed by these Chinese hackers. We know a long-running campaign by Chinese hackers to access commercial secrets. That has been something that's been going on for years, often if not decades. The change seems to be on the focus on these democratic institutions, and that is relatively new for China. China has a deeply sophisticated hacking and cybersecurity network, and it has human intelligence with that cybersecurity intelligence and these hacking groups layered on top of this. They have multiple tools at their disposal, but clearly they're becoming more aggressive and more assertive according to these allegations.
I think it's comments that the current Foreign Secretary, Lord David Cameron, and his then Chancellor, George Osborne, might regret now, referring to a golden era of Chinese relations, you know, nearly a decade ago. You talk about this as if it is, although it is a big news step, it is unsurprising in some ways that China is doing this. How did we go from that golden era to where we are today?
There's lots to pack into an answer on that question. There's everything from what the US and its Western allies would say are China's failures to live up to its commitments to the World Trade Organization that it joined in early 2000-2001, the repeated use of subsidies, the pushing of many of its industries outside of its own domestic market, flooding out markets in Europe and the US would be the contention from the West. All of that put together with the continued examples levels of Chinese hacking. And again, the shift, important shift that's happened in the last few years is the focus not just on stealing corporate secrets, but now on targeting members of Congress and parliamentarians here in the UK, as well as those in New Zealand as well. And the coordination by the Five Eyes, I think, is significant. Working together to release this at the same time, the three members, New Zealand, the UK and the US, to essentially have each other's back and to add ballast to these claims that, of course, China is reacting furiously to.
But then to pick up on something you said just a bit earlier, it's fascinating this has been released now, not just coordinated, but on these kind of, some of these claims of hacking go back a few years.
Yes.
In an election year for both the US and very likely the UK as well, and also when we're seeing over in the US Congress debates of over banning of TikTok, is there this kind of increasing fear in a lot of these Five Eyes countries that China is looking at their elections?
This is absolutely the fear. And we only need to look at the example of Russia and all the evidence of the role that Russia played in manipulating and being involved in that 2016 election in the US. The role that Russia played there, as has been very clearly demonstrated by the intelligence agencies in the US. That has very much put the US, the UK and others on high alert around their own elections and the risk that China could take a lead out of Russia's playbook to manipulate, lean on, try and shift or sow division within the electorate leading up to these elections to try and sway things in their favour. China has not done this in a comprehensive way yet, but certainly that is the fit. And there's lots of examples of where China has elicited and set up relations and formed partnerships with and connected with lawmakers in countries like Canada, in countries like Australia. And in fact, Australia put in place its own legal changes as a result of some of these influence campaigns that they say China was involved in. So it's moving from the in-person influence campaigns now to the cyber arm and the hacking arm and tools of the Chinese state.
I mean, we heard this morning from a UK minister that they don't want this to develop into a trade issue. I mean, what has China's response been? And what levers does the UK and the US have left to pull?
So China has come out and denied it very strongly indeed. And China will say and has said in the past that they are a victim of these kind of hacks. That will be the line from China. You'll get that consistently. In terms of the relationship, the trading relationship between the UK and the US, what you need to be watching for is whether or not China retaliates in some way, whether it steps up the targeting of UK businesses and operations on the ground in mainland China. There's an argument that they don't want to go down that route. We're seeing right now, today, it's playing out in Beijing, the courting of foreign business executives by China's leaders, desperate to put a halt to the outflows of investment out of that Chinese market. They want to see foreign investors, foreign executives investing in China, which we know is seeing a challenged economy. They don't want to put those foreign executives off. Nonetheless, the security establishment in China will be pushing for a response.
Bloomberg's Tom McKenzie, thank you very much. From cybersecurity to artificial intelligence, AI is the technology dominating headlines, with some predicting sweeping changes to every area of human life. The effects of AI on the way we work and how we find jobs is a hot topic. LinkedIn says it has seen a 9% increase in UK companies hiring AI technical talent over the past year. They add that professionals believe AI can help with their career progressions, but firms need to invest so employees can gain skills and unlock productivity benefits. My colleague Caroline Hepker has been speaking to LinkedIn's UK country manager Janine Chamberlain about the topic. She started by asking how the technology is changing the world of work.
What we can see at LinkedIn is that AI is changing the skills and the tools that every professional and every business needs. As you said, we've seen a 9% increase in UK businesses hiring AI talent, and that's really the technical talent. So think, for example, of machine learning specialists or AI engineers. But it isn't just about this technical talent. This is about all professionals requiring a degree of AI literacy. If you look at some of the data that predicts how much the skills are going to change going forward, just to do the jobs that we are doing today, by 2030, the skills are predicted to change by 65%. So if companies don't invest right now in upskilling their workforces to be able to use these AI tools that companies are investing in, they miss out on a great opportunity to unlock productivity in the workforce, but also they risk falling behind because the skills will continue to change so rapidly.
Yeah, absolutely. And the CEOs that I speak to, you know, they talk about the great potential of AI for the UK. I mean, what are AI skills? If I just slap AI proficient on my CV, does that qualify?
I think there's many ways of looking at it. And the way that I talk about all professionals requiring some AI literacy, this isn't about how we build AI tools or technology. So it's not that kind of deep skill set. It's about how do we use the tools that are presented to us today. For example, at LinkedIn, we have access to Microsoft's Copilot. Copilot can help people summarize meeting notes, summarizing an email, getting the highlights out of a PowerPoint presentation. All of these things that essentially help you to do your job more quickly, to do your job more efficiently. Those are the AI skills that I'm talking about. Experimenting with something like ChatGPT to allow you to become faster at producing some of the work that normally would have taken us a much longer time. Those are the AI skills that every professional would really benefit from.
The other issue is speed, isn't it? I mean, the UK had the AI Safety Summit only last year, but even since then, some in the AI world have talked about the fact, you know, that the UK's workforce are not quickly acquiring these skills, that could be problematic. Does the UK actually have an edge in terms of AI skills?
So I think if you look at the UK and how the UK ranks globally, what we can see in our data from an AI skills perspective, we rank sixth. And the top five countries are India, the US, Germany, Canada, and Israel. And what's interesting, though, if you look at UK employees, UK professionals, there's a huge appetite for people from people to learn more about AI. I think two-thirds of employees believe that it will ultimately help them progress in their careers. But only half of business leaders are taking action right now to upskill their employees. And this is where they have a huge opportunity by investing in that upskilling piece, for example, by offering learning courses, encouraging people just to play around with AI and really making it a daily habit. This is where companies can get that competitive edge.
How is AI changing the process of looking for a job in and of itself? And I mentioned, you know, school teachers and young people using AI. I mean, if everyone is, for example, writing their CV using AI and AI is reading all of those CVs, what does that mean?
Yeah, I think this is really important to kind of consider, what does AI actually provide? It doesn't replace someone's job and it doesn't replace someone's effort to write a CV. This is just about giving people a helping hand, a starting point. You know, when you have a blank sheet of paper in front of you, it can be really hard to start writing down all of the experiences that you have, all of the skills that you have. What AI provides is a little helping hand to get you started. Ultimately, it's still the skills and the experiences that the individual brings to the job. It's still the interview that the individual is going to have to show up for, the assessments that they're going to have to pass. So this is just creating a jumping off point that makes it easier to get started.
Really? I'm surprised that you say that. I would imagine that there'd be a great deal of temptation to have AI write your entire CV for you.
I think that is tempting, but I think we also need to bear in mind that AI is still developing. And so it wouldn't be a replacement of the work that we can do entirely today. We have to make sure that our own sort of individual style comes through in our CV, that we check what AI is pulling out of somewhere for us. If we look at how we do this on LinkedIn, AI can actually look at someone's profile and kind of pull out, here are the skills, for example, that would match a certain job, a certain career that you are interested in. Here are the skills that you can highlight on your CV, ultimately to stand out better. But it isn't going to create that skill in an individual.
No, sure. It's about the writing of it, the delivery of the message, I suppose. Look, I'm also interested not just in AI, but your view on the UK jobs market overall at the moment. For example, the recent jobs data, official jobs data that we had, showed a doubling in redundancies. And then the Bank of England Governor Andrew Bailey, in his most recent comments, saying that Britain is in a very rare position of halving inflation without also losing jobs. I mean, the jobs market is cooling, though, isn't it? And how quickly?
I think the jobs market is a little bit calmer than it was several years ago. And I'll go back to the point around businesses having to invest in their talent ultimately to make sure that not only they create more productivity in the workplace, but also that they allow their workforce to start focusing on more strategic tasks, on more innovative tasks, really thinking about how do we bring the best out of the workforce. The human-centered skills are really coming more to the forefront right now. And that's ultimately what's going to drive success for businesses. It's going to drive growth for businesses and will help us to kind of create a more buoyant jobs market overall.
That was LinkedIn UK country manager Jean Chamberlain speaking to Caroline Hepke on Bloomberg Radio earlier today. Jobs, housing, pensions. We've been talking about them all on the podcast in recent weeks. Now, one of the central levers of the economy is the Bank of England's base rate. It's currently at the highest level in 16 years. That affects mortgage rates, the interest people make in savings accounts, how much companies pay to hold debt. So one of the key questions for the UK economy is, with inflation at 3.4%, when are they going to move it lower? And that could in turn affect the election something. Now, our editor-at-large, Francine Lacroix, has sat down with one of the nine economists tasked with making that call, Catherine Mann. Have a listen to their conversation.
So there are really three main reasons why I thought it was time to move from a rate hike in February to the hold from last week. And they really have to do with consumers disciplining the pricing behavior of firms. These are something I've been talking about for some time. The second one had to do with a changing dynamic in the labor market between labor demand on the part of firms and labor supply coming both from households wanting to add more hours. And of course, the fiscal package associated with the national insurance that was expected by the OBR to increase the number of full-time equivalent workers. And then number three has to do with the financial market curve. And at least on these first two, there was quite a bit of progress from February to March.
So the BOE's estimate, Dr. Mann, you know, is that inflation will fall. You've been very concerned before about underlying inflationary pressures. What's your sense now about how worrying those pressures are?
Well, I've always talked about the differences between the deceleration in goods prices, which is something that we've seen happening on account of the change in energy prices, as well as changes in global goods prices. These translate into zero, very close to zero inflation for goods in the UK market. Now, services, on the other hand, this is the area that has always been my concern, because even now, on a year-over-year basis, services are still running at 6%. So how have I changed my view? Well, when I look at the discretionary services, we're looking at hotels, restaurants, entertainment, travel. These in the last couple of months have really started to soften. And those are the most discretionary things in a consumer basket. So when those start to soften, it's because people have finally decided, you know, I'm not going to pay that much. I'm not going to go to a restaurant that is charging me this much. And that discipline, that consumer discipline, is a very important ingredient when we think about firms choosing pricing strategies. Basically, firms have to respond to consumers saying, I'm not going to pay that much. And I do see that coming through on the data for these discretionary services. So that is why one of the key reasons why I decided that it was time to move to a hold. But the second reason, and I said it has to do with the labor market, 6 months ago, when we looked at the behavior of the labor market, talking to firms, using our agent network, and using our surveys for households, what we found is that households wanted to respond to the cost of living crisis by adding additional hours, maybe a second job. And firms were willing to go along with that 6 months ago. But where we are now is that firms actually are saying, because my wage bill is pretty high, what I want to do is cut hours and I don't want to add more headcount. So there's a disconnect between what firms want and what households would like to have in terms of labor supply. And as I say, there's this additional aspect, which is the expectation based on the OER of the implications of the fiscal package associated with the national insurance that is expected to add 200,000 full-time equivalent workers. So you have firms wanting less and households and the fiscal policy wanting more. And that disconnect in the labor market, I think, is something we will start to observe in wage dynamics very soon.
So given all of this, and even pre this, there's been a lot of betting that the BOE will soon switch to cutting interest rates. When do you think lower borrowing costs will be an option for you and for the BOE?
Well, I think we have to remember, Francine, that the only interest rate we set is bank rate. And that's very, very short term. The rest of the market curve is market based on market expectations, based on competition among financial institutions. And there has been quite a bit of easing already, even from the March vote. You know, in some sense, we can hold bank rate for quite some time, and the financial markets will already be easing on expectations of future cuts. My concern is that, and my fundamental reason why I voted to hike in February was, and at that point, I thought that the financial markets had been easing too much relative to what I thought was the appropriate overall curve for the UK economy. I think that there has been a substantial easing even since the vote last week. I think that perhaps markets are a bit too complacent about how long they think the BOE overall, the MPC, will hold rates. But of course, I can't speak for my colleagues. And we are going into a forecast round for May. And we'll see what the data, how the data present themselves over the next few weeks.
And I want to get back to actually what the markets are expecting in a second, but we heard both from Andrew Bailey, but also Hugh Pill, saying that policy would remain restrictive even if rates were cut. Real rates are also rising as policy remains steady and inflation is falling. So how do you see those arguments?
Well, again, I think that we have to put this in the context of what the financial markets are doing with the nominal rates. Those are coming down substantially, as I say, even since last week. And so embedded in that is easing regardless of what we do with bank rate. So I think we really have to recognize that the policy instrument that we have is a very short-term instrument, and the rest of the curve has to do with competition between various financial institutions, if we think of mortgage rates, for example, overall expectations of cuts going forward. Those are expectations based on markets. We know that markets sometimes get it right, sometimes they don't. You know, we'll have to wait to see if they get it right this time.
But Dr. Mann, when you say markets are being too complacent, are they pricing in too many cuts or not enough?
I think they're pricing in too many cuts. That would be my personal view. So in some sense, I don't have to cut because the market already is. In terms of the implications of, you know, the market curve is, and mortgage rates, for example, those are the rates that are faced by borrowers. Bank rate is not the rate that borrowers face.
But how many interest rate cuts do you think we'll see from the Bank of England this year?
Well, I really can't say. I mean, there's a lot of year left to go. The market's expectation is the one that a lot of people are betting money on it. So, you know, you figure that if anybody has it right, they do. But, you know, the degree to which the market curve has moved in the last, you know, in the last week, but even more since the beginning of the year. You know, we have 100 basis points of a swing in the market curve. And that suggests to me that there is uncertainty about in the market about exactly the conduct of the economy and the performance going forward. And the data are unfolding with regard to the degree of strength in the underlying economy, the degree of strength or deceleration in underlying inflation. And so I think there is quite a bit of play in terms of how the economy's performance is going forward. And that is one reason why we are seeing the degree of moving up and down of the curve. And we also, of course, have to recognize that the market curve in the UK is importantly affected by the market curves in and the decisions of our two neighbors, two neighboring central banks and economies, Europe on the one hand and the United States on the other.
Yeah, and traders are betting actually that Bank of England could beat European and U.S. peers in these interest rate cuts, and they're pricing in three cuts this year for the BOE. Does that look excessive? And actually, how rapid could the pivot be towards lower rates?
Yeah. So when we look at the data comparing the deceleration in inflation and underlying wages for the U.S., the U.K., and the euro area, it's a presentation that we've had in the monetary policy report over the last several issues. And we find that comparison to be particularly interesting and valuable when considering not only the conduct of the UK economy, but also the potential spillovers from monetary policy choices and decisions at our, you know, both the Federal Reserve and the ECB. And one of the things that comes out of that comparison is that wage dynamics in the UK are stronger and more persistent than the wage dynamics in either the United States or the euro area. And underlying services dynamics are also stickier, more persistent than either the U.S. or the euro area. So on that basis, it's hard to argue that the BOE would be ahead of the other two regions, particularly the United States.
Right. Catherine Mann, the former Fed chair, Ben Bernanke, is, of course, doing this review of BOE forecasting and communication methods in response to criticism that the BOE missed the jump on inflation. What do you think should be done to improve the process at the BOE?
So the Bernanke report is will be coming out at some point, and it will be very interesting to see the overall reaction to it outside. You know, there are a lot of different elements of the forecast process. What I think is an important part of the process, especially over the last 2 years, when, you know, the economy has been hit by multiple shocks, is an understanding of how asymmetric processes work in the economy, how nonlinearities work in the economy. And many of the models that we use, and I've been on the model building side at numerous of my other jobs, most models simply are tend to be linear and symmetric. That's just the way they work. They're big. They have a lot of interactions. They tend to work be constructed to be linear and symmetric. That doesn't mean you can't bolt on important research that helps you understand how firms react in a nonlinear situation or an asymmetric situation. And I think thinking seriously about how to integrate partial equilibrium or firm level analysis, or how consumers react, or how deciles, different income deciles, those behaviors are different, how to incorporate that disaggregation into a macroeconomic setting, that's something that I think is worthy of more analysis within our own forecasting process.
Okay. Have you spoken to Ben Bernanke, and do you think the BOE should do dot plots like the Fed?
Well, yeah, Bernanke did quite a bit of research, speaking with many, many people, both within the bank as well as outside, at all levels, staff all the way up to the top. So he had a very comprehensive interview set in order to understand the background of the overall process. On dot plots, I think, you know, we kind of, we do better than dot plots. We tell you exactly how we vote, and we give speeches and interviews to tell you why. So we give you a lot more information than a dot plot.
Bank of England Monetary Policy Committee member Catherine Mann there in conversation with Francine Lacroix. Afraid that's all we've got time for today. If you like the programme, don't forget to subscribe and give it 5 stars so other people can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify or wherever you listen. This episode was produced by Tiwa Adebayo and our audio engineer was Marufal Hussain. I'm James Wilcock. We'll be back with more tomorrow. This is Bloomberg.
Bloomberg UK Politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.